This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending Friday, 8th of December 2017. Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of the Hampshire Chronicle from the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper. Liz and Gordon Legg have edited the extract this week. We'll begin with the usual regular notices, and the first is to say, if you do know someone who is sight impaired or would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870 370. That's 01962 870 370. And as you listen to the recording, remember you can use the buttons on your box to move on from an item before it finishes, or back to any of the tracks if you want to listen again. And just one more reminder, this is for those of you with computers or tablets. As well as using your memory stick in the box, you can also access the weekly recording of the Chronicle from our website, www.winchestertalkingnews.com. That's all lowercase, no spaces. www.winchestertalkingnews.com. Just go to the website, click on News on the header bar, locate the recording you want to hear, and click Download. The recordings are listed in date order. The most recent is first on the list. And so let's look at this week's edition of the Chronicle. Our readers today are Andrew Parkinson.
Good morning.
And Jerry Tuff.
Good morning.
And I'm your presenter, Ros Lydiard. So on to the news. The leading headlines this week are Future Uncertain for Hospital A&E, Security Bollards to be installed in the city centre, Athlete's coach is jailed for 14 years. And the first headline story, please, Jerry.
Future uncertain for Hospital A&E. Health bosses have refused to confirm the future of Winchester's A&E as plans move forward to centralise hospital services in North and Mid-Hampshire. Concerns have been raised about the emergency facilities at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, RHCH, after it was decided that a plan for a new £150 million critical treatment hospital off Junction 7 of the M3 would be shelved in favour of alternative centralisation proposals. Last week, the boards of the North and Mid-Hampshire Clinical Commission Groups, CCG, approved recommendations to scrap the new hospital plans as they were deemed unaffordable. Alex Whitfield, Hampshire Hospitals Foundation Trust Chief Executive, said, "We're naturally disappointed that the recommendation to the Commissioners' meeting is not to consult with the public on a critical treatment hospital at this time." Ms. Whitfield added, "We know we're going to have to do something to continue to provide great care. We believe the proposed build site at Junction 7 would have been ideal. It would enable our staff to focus on dedicated care. HHFT demonstrated that this was affordable." The meeting heard that the figures for the expected demand over the life of the new hospital differed between the Trust and the CCG report, which changed the financial analysis considerably. As well as confirming that the plans will be shelved, the boards voted to continue developing proposals for the centralisation of HHFT healthcare services, including exploring any necessary capital development to support relocation of services. When asked by the campaign group Hampshire and the Isle of Wight Defend Our NHS campaign to confirm the future of an A&E at the RHCH, health bosses said a decision could not be made yet. Heather Housechild, chief officer at West Hampshire CCG, told board members, there is still work to do, so we're not at a stage where we can say what it will look like. We hope that we would be able to conclude by the end of February. The decision has been met with fear from campaigners fighting to keep an A&E in Winchester. A spokesman for the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Defend Our NHS campaign told the Hampshire Chronicle, "We feel the public in Winchester and the surrounds need to be made aware that their A&E is under serious threat of closure. These joint boards have now given themselves the task to, by the end of February, without public consultation, work further on refining their case for these changes. Today's meeting decided against a new hospital, which they themselves recognised as clinically to the good of the public, was unaffordable. Yet again, our underfunded, understaffed and overstretched NHS is told that what is good is unaffordable." However, Winchester MP Steve Bryan said, "The RHCH must retain a front door. Let's call that an emergency department, but it can only do so with safe and sustainable services behind. What goes on inside is far more important than what the sign says outside. As I've repeatedly said, it's important to understand what Winchester Hospital is now before we get worked up about its future." Mr. Bryan added that he would be working closely with HHFT in the future to ensure there's appropriate consultant-led cover in the city. Work will be carried out by the HHFT to review the care services at its three hospitals, with the aim of developing new proposals by the end of February to reconfigure services, with a board meeting in March to consider the options. What do you think? Write to letters@hampshirechronicle.co.uk.
This story is headlined, "Security Bollards to be Installed in City Centre." Civic chiefs will be installing barricades in Winchester following fears that the city could be hit by a Nice-style terror attack under plans for a major redevelopment of the city centre. As previously reported, plans for the Silver Hill 2 scheme, officially known as the Central Winchester Regeneration Project, CWR, were praised by members of the Winchester City Council's Overview and Scrutiny Committee. But Councillor Linda Gemmell questioned how the pedestrianisation of the city centre would affect Winchester's security. Councillor Gemmell, Conservative member for the Central Meon Valley Ward, said, "It illustrates beautifully the free movement of people through Winchester, but I'm aware of the implications that give us as a terrorist target." Following terror attacks in Nice in 2016, as well as Westminster and Barcelona this year, which saw vehicles being driven with crowds of pedestrians, Councillor Gemmell added that, under the CWR plans, what was to stop terrorists driving a lorry past King Alfred statue and ploughing into pedestrians in the Broadway and High Street? Now, the City Council, in a joint statement with the County Council and Winchester Business Improvement District, has said that bollards will be installed to counter a potential terrorist attack using vehicles. A spokesman said, "In common with many other town centres across the UK, temporary barriers will be installed in Winchester to ensure shopkeepers, residents and visitors feel reassured during the busy festive season. Installations of this kind are increasingly considered, quote, business as usual, unquote, for any event that involves high footfall, and our footfall increases significantly across the city during the run-up to Christmas." Catherine Turnus, Chief Executive of Winchester BID, added, "Winchester is a special place at Christmas, and these temporary barriers minimise business and visitors' concerns when visiting our city. Temporary obstacles have already been installed in the outer close." A draft supplementary planning document, an SPD, produced by architects JPT, was unveiled by the council in October. The document sets out how the council aims to provide space for shopping, working, living, leisure, culture, and heritage through a mix of quiet riverside walks and active shopping streets, as well as various types of housing around the Silver Hill area of the city. The plans went to the council's cabinet yesterday for approval to begin formal consultations. A launch exhibition will be held on Monday, December the 11th, between 2 p.m. and 9 p.m. at the Guildhall.
Athletics coach is jailed for 14 years. A former teacher and Winchester athletics coach has been jailed for 15 years for abusing underage girls by giving them massages and taking photographs of them naked in the bath. Richard Hillary of North End Lane, Droxford, was found guilty of 14 counts of indecent assault against five girls dating back to the 70s and 80s. The offences happened while Hillary worked as a PE teacher at the Wavell School in Farnborough and also as a running coach at Winchester Athletics Club. The trial at Winchester Crown Court heard that the defendant, known as Dick, would take naked pictures of his victims as well as taking the girls to secluded beauty spots where he asked them to perform sex acts on him. Some of his victims kept account of their diaries of the assaults, which included the teacher having smoochy dances with the girls before asking them for Christmas kisses. Detective Constable Sarah Fox said Hillary used his position of authority as both a PE teacher and a sports coach to gain the trust of these girls, who are now women, and he abused that trust in the most awful way. He maintained that he hadn't done anything wrong throughout our investigation and continued in this vein throughout the court process, which has been especially difficult for the victims. We don't underestimate the long-lasting effects that this sort of offence has on victims. I would like to thank the women involved for their courage in coming forward and reliving these horrendous experiences in the courtroom. Professor John Welling said Richard Hillary abused his position of trust as a teacher to indecently insulting young girls that he had responsibility for. Hillary is described by many of his victims as a popular and dynamic teacher, a fact he exploited as he groomed the girls into performing sexual acts for him. The CPS was able to use teenage diaries of his victims, which made clear Hillary's crimes at the time they happened and provided compelling evidence to put before the jury. I commend the victims who reported Hillary and supported this prosecution. Hillary was acquitted in 2014 of offences against another girl, but her evidence was used in the new trial to help convict the pensioner, who was also head teacher of Cambridge Park School in Southampton for 12 years. In addition to the prison sentence, Judge Susan Evans, QC, ordered Hillary to sign on the sex offenders register for life. In a statement released during the trial, which can only be reported now, the athletics club said, Winchester and District Athletics Club, WADAC, is aware of the ongoing trial of Richard Hillary from reports in the local press. The reported incidents are alleged to have taken place sometime in the past. Richard Hillary is not a coach at the club and is no longer associated in any way with the activities of WADAC. The club wishes to reassure all club members and the general public that we have strict welfare policies in place and that all coaches involved with WADAC are subject to DBS checks and hold up to date English athletics coaching licences. We'll have the death notices for you now, and then Andrew will follow with Christian comment. The death notices: Alison Ellen Jean Allison, known as Jean, passed away at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital on the 25th of November at the age of 91. Castle, Fred Castle, on the 30th of November, aged 73.
Edwards, Heather Mary Edwards, passed away peacefully on the 24th of November at the Countess Mountbatten Hospice, aged 76 years.
Hayes, Michael Hayes, on 29th of November, aged 76.
Lashley, Earl Lashley, peacefully at the Countess of Brecknock Hospice on the 28th of November, aged 88. McDowell, Ronald Ronnie McDowell, passed away peacefully on Friday the 1st of December, aged 81 years.
Mills, Andrew Mills, formerly of Hampton Lane, died suddenly on the 17th of November, aged 54.
Ran, Adrian Christopher Dale Andy Ran, passed peacefully on the 1st of December in the excellent care of University Hospital Southampton, aged 64.
Taylor, Sandra Grace Taylor, formerly of Bentworth and the Isle of Wight, passed peacefully away at St Catherine's View, Winchester, on the 20th of November. Upfield, Nat Nelson Upfield, passed away at home on the 30th of November, aged 84 years.
Wilkes, Mary Wilkes, LRAM, passed away on the 2nd of December at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, aged 90.
And as I said, we're going to have Christian comment now, which is going to be read for us by Andrew. It's contributed this week by the Reverend Graham Bowkett. Thanks, Andrew.
And the headline for this article is The Only Gift at Christmas. I'm writing this in mid-November, so happy Christmas, everybody. The adverts are out. The celebrity jungle thing, which I cannot take my eyes off each year, has started. I've wrapped my first present, and my wife even went to work today wearing a Christmas jumper. Apparently it's de rigueur. Let the onslaught begin. This is where I, as a Christian, am theoretically going to get all flaky about Advent and its meaning, and make as many disparaging comments about the capitalist takeover of the Christian narrative as I can pack into 500 words. Strike at the heart of all that is wrong and demand everyone answers the question, the perennial question, what has modern Christmas celebrations got to do with Christmas? Well, I'm not going to, because we all know that on the high street, broadly, the answer is nothing. It's just a brilliant excuse to make some people rich and, sadly, other people poorer. According to the Gospel of Luke, it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God, heaven. But of course, every rich person I have ever met claims richness is relative. I have even met people who are fabulously wealthy but claim borderline poverty because they drive a 4-year-old Range Rover. I make light. What is really sad, and my eventual point, is that it is not the commercial assault and the theft of the Christmas celebration that makes me really sad, but rather, in doing so, there seems to be an attempt to replace the wonder and awe of a gift from God with a gift from the high street. The spirituality of the event is lost in gooey sentimentality and misdirected soppiness. Now, the scholars of spirituality out there will immediately ask, what do you mean by spirituality? Do you mean Eastern or Western spirituality? Secular, esoteric, interfaith, health, gender, economic, business, or even, bizarrely, capital spirituality? But hold on. What about educational, age-related, women's, New Age spirituality? Surely you do not accuse them all, do you? Well, yes, mostly all of them. And because it really depends on how they are practiced. Often they are about the individual practiced in a hedonistic and relative way. They, in our Western world, are simply about making the individual feel better, more content, more in harmony with oneself. Choose one, anyone. It's about private tastes. It's just like Christmas on the high street. You pay your money, you make your choice. The word spirituality, and this might surprise you, owes its origin directly to the Christian context. Formerly, there was no direct parallel word outside of Western language, despite everyone else's wish to claim it. Spirituality is profoundly Christian and firmly grounded in the desire to seek the transcendent reality, the divine God, who loved the world so much he gave us Jesus. Jesus, the only present, the only gift anyone could ever really want or ever need. All the other stuff is rubbish, superfluous, irrelevant, including spectrum, personal, comparative spirituality. That's the top of my list of rubbish.
Thank you very much, Andrew. And now we've got letters to the editor, and the first one we have is about Barton Farm, where, as you know, is a very popular subject, and you will hear two or three letters here on the subject. This one is written by A. Fife, and it's entitled, predictably, Lego Houses. Sir, like earlier correspondents on this subject, I too have been dismayed at the appearance of the latest crop of houses on Barton Farm, a.k.a. King's Barton. As the photograph in this issue shows clearly, the design and layout seems to have been inspired by a Lego kit and have absolutely no visual appeal whatsoever. An average 10-year-old could have done better. In an unattractive, straight lines, these properties stand like a line of soldiers on parade. Repetitive, angular roof lines denominate the skyline, proclaiming their mediocrity and lack of imagination, Carla homes more like Lego homes. Cast your mind back to the computer-generated images we were given showing what the new development would look like. So far, the computer-generated images bear no resemblance to what is happening on the ground. The diverted traffic from Andover Road is also significantly missing from the misleading GCIs. Public disappointment is understandable, but city council planners who gave their plan disapproval must be accountable. I expected better than this, and suspect that most people who regularly pass the site must feel the same. I feel I've been misled about Barton Farm. I can only hope that later phases of this development will show some semblance of imagination and flair. After all, it is the latest single housing development that Winchester has ever seen and should be a showplace. One thing is for sure, Winchester deserves better than this. And that's from A5, Hairstock Road, Hairstock, Winchester.
This contribution is headed Diversion Backed, and it was sent in by J. Milne. Sir, I agree with those people who have written in support not only of the Barton Farm housing development, but who also understand the rationale for closing the existing Andover Road. The design of the development is predicated on integrating it with existing housing on the other side of the road, bordering Hairstock, as well as meeting current national and local planning policy. The current road maintains a division between the two communities and loses the exciting opportunity to provide an interesting, safe, pedestrianised entrance to Winchester for people rather than cars. It seems to be an unfortunate fact that we cannot expect to develop an additional 2,000 homes without extra traffic. It is also unfortunate that many car journeys taken are of short duration. Park and Ride is being built at the northern end of the site, and the increased public transport and potential for walking and cycling once the existing road is closed will hopefully minimize this effect. We know from the Institute of Economic Affairs January 2017 report, titled Obesity and the Public Purse, that obesity is a major health problem. We need, therefore, to support and encourage people to easily access opportunities to exercise. We are aware of the environmental impact of traffic on climate change, and we know air pollution is a major problem here. Indeed, your own paper published an article last year stating, and I quote, "Winchester is one of the worst polluted parts of Hampshire," unquote. The moving of the road also appears to be in line with the National Planning Policy Framework, which requires that plans, quote, "protect and support opportunities for the use of sustainable transport modes for the movement of goods or people," unquote. Proposals for the Central Winchester development area describe a pedestrian cycle-friendly environment that encourages and promotes active travel and reduces dependence on other modes of transport. It is also in line with the current district plan, which states housing, employment, and community development proposals will be expected to demonstrate conformity with the making the use of public transport, walking, and cycling easy to reduce non-essential car use. The City of Winchester Movement Strategy, currently out for consultation, provides an opportunity for people to have their say about envisaging a healthy and more active city in the future. And that was contributed by Jay Milne of Andover Road North, Winchester.
A third letter about Barton Farm comes from Andrew Rutter, the retired conservation architect. Estate design shortfalls. Recent letters about Barton Farm have provoked me to comment, although I was never involved in the planning application. Firstly, it seems wrong, in principle, to divert the through traffic of a major radial road into a housing one. However, to have a bus loop into it seems eminently sensible, so as to pick up the maximum number of passengers. A recent correspondence suggested that it was the County Council's requirement for additional land for Henry Beaufort School, and their refusal to contemplate students' access via a bridge that has led to the diversion, although never publicised. I received the same answer to a direct question at the planning exhibition. I can understand, from a general grounds maintenance point of view, that one wouldn't want the two sites separated by a radial road. So to keep the road on its present line would require the substantial cost of a bridge accessed by ramps, capable of carrying both maintenance vehicles and students safely over the road. I wouldn't have thought this unreasonable on such a large development. Another reader commented on the unattractiveness of a cluster of individual houses, boxes. This sort of extreme individualism is only redeemed by subsequent gardening and tree planting. Housing architects have always known that you get a more satisfactory visual environment on a large site if individual houses are combined into terraces and other blocks, which makes a truly urban environment of streets and squares, ideal for playgrounds. Winchester is full of examples of relatively cheap Victorian housing up to high-class terraces, and Hyde seems a well-liked area. To make terraces acceptable in the 21st century, it is essential that building regulations insist on structures that don't allow noise to penetrate between units, either sideways or vertically. Terraces have the advantage of less external wall to heat, and they can be designed to make solar panels an integral feature of the design and not an add-on. They can also produce a higher density to make frequent bus services viable. I also wonder whether, to reduce the initial purchase cost, some houses could be built as shells with minimum sanitary services, so that young people could then finish the interior in their own time, an idea suggested but rejected at Badger Farm. I think it's a tragedy that since I was trained as an architect, so much of this country has been developed with an emphasis on individuality and very little on architectural merit. Now this makes it difficult to rise to the challenge of climate change. Andrew Rutter, retired conservation architect, St John's Road, Winchester.
And now, by way of a change, but for a subject which also has been in the press very much just lately, this one is Brexit disarray, and it's from Roderick Martin. Sir, the return of the EU exit bill to Parliament is the time for considering progress so far. The May government has proved even less competent than the Cameron government. Brexit negotiations founder, handling the complexities of the Brexit process appears to be beyond the capacity of the UK government, with whom the initiative rests. After all, the UK is seeking to change existing arrangements. The government is in disarray, the laughing stock of Europe. In the meantime, the UK economy languishes, the second lowest rate of growth in Europe, above only Greece, and with productivity well below European competitors, Germany and France. The UK's employment miracle is a mirage, obscuring a low wage, low productivity, low security reality. Brexit has been justified by the slogan, "Take back control. The people have spoken," not evidence and argument. Perhaps Mr. Brine could explain his position for his constituents. Rising prices will not concern self-appointed tribunes of the people like Sir Joseph Rees-Mogg, sheltered by his offshore millions, but they are already painful for everyone else. And that was from Roderick Markton of Mead Close, St Cross, Winchester.
This is a letter from Dr. Carl Brooks, and it's titled "Disgraceful Decision on New Hospital." Sir, the decision this week by the two clinical commissioning groups not to support the development of a critical treatment hospital is a disgrace, and I refer to the Chronicle, November 30th. It deprives the people of Hampshire of the best quality hospital care that is fit for the 21st century. Heather Housechild, chief officer of West Hampshire's Clinical Care Commissioning Group, asks that the CCG boards take into account the needs of our children and grandchildren. The decision that was taken instead was based on the austere financial constraints of the day and has consigned the healthcare of future generations to two crumbling edifices. This short-sighted conclusion leaves Hampshire hospitals in limbo, with no support to develop its services, and with a very negative impact on its ability to recruit the best clinical staff and offer optimal emergency care. This is a truly terrible decision, and we should not allow it to be swept under the carpet. And that's from Dr. Carl Brooks, Hannington, Basingstoke.
This letter from Brian Parker is headed "Bus Station." As a regular user of bus services in and out of Winchester, mainly the 69 to and from Bishop's Waltham, I would like to say how tired I am of reading in this paper criticism of the refurbished bus station on the Broadway. As we all know, the whole area of Silver Hill has an uncertain future until Winchester City Council, alongside its business partners, decides the best way forward. In the meantime, can we not all agree that the layout that is there now far surpasses what was there previously? One of the major advantages of the new use of Friar's Gate for bus routes is that buses are no longer driving up the high street and then queuing in front of the main entrance to Sainsbury's, which used to be a challenge, mixing pedestrians and large vehicles. As I wait for my bus on my way home, I am protected from the wind and rain by the shelters provided. I can also pop out to check the time from the clock at the top of the Guildhall, a sight not available until recent changes. With a slight caveat that it would be nice if they could provide proper signage rather than laminated A4 sheets cable tied to the railings, I think the bus company has done a reasonable job under the circumstances. If you have a 4x4, it doesn't need to be in Winchester. Leave it at home, use the bus, wear a coat and stop moaning. Brian Parker, The Hawthorns, Bishop's Waltham.
This next letter is on the subject of NHS waste. It's from Keith Webb. Sir, we are told that the NHS does not have enough money, but they could do very much better with what they're already receiving and still give an improved service. We believe, read, that the proposed new critical care hospital near Basingstoke is not going to be built. After much soul-searching, many millions of pounds have been wasted on the project. Quite apart from such waste, there are examples where money could be saved. Apparently, many items prescribed for patients cost much more than if a patient gets them him or herself. For example, painkillers like paracetamol or aspirin, and doing so avoids having to pay for the set prescription charge. There also seems no way in which the overprescribed items can be returned to the pharmacist. I was told that they have to throw them away, even if sealed. There seems to be no centralised buying system for items used throughout the health service, for example, things like disposable gloves. The result is that what is paid varies hugely from trust to trust. Why? On the local front, I regularly visit the recycling centre in Winchester and see NHS crutches, etc. being dumped as scrap aluminium. I will say aluminium as a correction there. I questioned the operator of the metals he received recently about this, and he told me that the hospital will not take such items back as they have to be sterilised and it costs more to do this than buy new. It is obviously easier to take things to the dump than return them to the hospital and incur car parking charges. But this is ridiculous. Knowing that the Red Cross depot in Eastleigh provides such items on loan, free of charge, to anyone needing them, I have volunteered to take any dumped crutches to the Red Cross when I am in the area. Among your readers, there are probably many who can provide other examples of NHS waste, and they should be invited to write about their own experiences in the hope that someone will notice and someone will act to save money. The NHS should learn to look after the pennies rather than constantly call for more funds. And that's from Keith Webb, Quarry Road, Winchester.
And this letter takes us back to the buses, a common subject. This letter is titled False Economy and is written by Joyce Meadowcroft. Sir, I wonder whether the relevant councillors would take into consideration the following thoughts regarding the likely charges to be levied by Hampshire County Council on pensioners who hold bus passes. Regrettably, we accept that we might have to pay something towards this concession in order for us to be able to continue to benefit from it. However, this sum being payable every time we step onto a bus is something of a postcode lottery. If, as we do, one lives in Kingsworthy, Hairstock or Wick, and indeed many other places, a trip to the hospital and back involves at least 4 bus rides. If one then wants to accompany one's partner, this then doubles to 8 trips per visit. As we age, these trips are unfortunately much more frequent. It becomes much more likely that we would take our car instead of using public transport, as the cost is much the same as parking and petrol. Additionally, how are the buses going to be able to keep to their tight schedules if the drivers have to collect 50p or a pound from each pensioner travelling on every trip? We feel, if necessary, it would be far fairer to add an annual charge for bus pass holders rather than a per-ride charge. This makes the cost the same for everyone, regardless of where they live. Those pensioners who do not want to make use of their passes would not need to be issued with them, thus making savings here. We would rather pay 20 to 30 pounds a year towards our passes than have to pay for each trip. And that's from Joyce Meadowcroft of Felmer Drive, Kingsworthy.
This letter from John Seeger Green is entitled Castle for Homes. Although I've lived in Winchester but 18 years, I've never heard anyone suggest that we were in need of a skating rink, let alone a permanent Olympic-sized skating arena. And therefore, view the proposal for such a facility at the old depot site in Bar End with a degree of reservation. What would have a much greater impact upon Winchester would be for Hampshire County Council to move its entire facilities, offices and the like to Bar End, thereby opening an opportunity for the creation of a large number of residential units in the centre of the city by the conversion of the brick-built section of the council offices, with consequential enhancement for the demand for additional shops and the local economy generally. The possible release of commercial office space, which we're told the city lacks, and, if required, an hotel by reusing the newer existing county council space. Commuting traffic would be reduced and congestion eased, while access to and from the new council offices would be readily available from the existing bus route. Not only would this new residential space in the centre of the city be attractive to the more mature citizens, with the station but a step or two away, younger residents commuting to London elsewhere would find it ideal. Also, there is little downside for the County Council. The vacated property would have considerable value, access unaffected, and the cost-saving advantages of having all departments under one roof would be considerable. A win-win situation is created. John Seeger Green, Hospital of St Cross, St Cross Road, Winchester.
Thanks very much, both. And that's the end of Letters to the Editor. We're now going to move on to the column Your Say, where people in the streets of Winchester are asked questions such as, this time, with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle announcing their engagement, the Chronicle's roving reporter asked people what they thought of the match. And Andrew will tell us.
And as you might expect, there's quite a wide range of opinions to that that question. Roland Clark, 80, retired of Willis Way, Kingsworthy, said, and I quote, "It will be good for the relationship between the US and the UK. And it's good for the country. It couldn't be better, really." A slightly different view was taken by Laura Anya, 25, a waitress in Winchester, who said, "It's not a good thing. I don't think it's a good match. It's not traditional because she's not English." Another view came from Faye Lehman, 18, student of Romsey Road, Winchester, and originally from Hanover, Germany, and she said, and I quote, "I think everyone is excited about it. It's good news. She seems very nice." And finally, from Mark Kelly, 59, a tax driver from Littleton, said, and I quote, "It's good just to keep the country uplifted through austerity. We get another wedding or the Jubilee every few years." And those are some of the comments by the correspondent on the street.
And very varied, weren't they? Thank you very much, Andrew. If you have an opinion or a subject you'd like to air in the Hampshire Chronicle, you can contact them on 01962 860 836. That's 01962 860 836. Or you can email, all lowercase, no spaces, news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. Or you could write to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester SO23 8AL. Or you could even drop in when you are in Winchester. Moving on now to Chronicle comment, and the editor's heading this time is Right to Take Action to Deter Attacks. A sensible precaution or daft overreaction? Numerous concrete blocks were being placed in Winchester city centre yesterday to stop a terrorist driving at speed into the hundreds of people crowding into the city for the ice rink and the market. We have reported that permanent obstacles will be considered as part of the Silver Hill 2 scheme to regenerate the city centre. Winchester is not the only place to see tighter security in the wake of recent terror attacks. Similar plans are in place for the Guildhall Square and above Bar Street in Southampton. Following attacks in Nice in 2016, as well as Westminster and Barcelona, which saw vehicles being driven at crowds of pedestrians, towns and cities across the country are beefing up security. Some would argue that by taking these measures, the authorities are raising public fears and undermining a sense of security, and so helping terrorists achieve their ends. The risks of such attack are extremely low. But these attacks do happen, and Winchester, the ancient capital of England before London, would quite possibly be on a terrorist long list of soft targets. So, on balance, the authorities are right to be cautious, and the public can be reassured as thousands of extra shoppers and visitors hit our streets in the run-up to Christmas. This next item is first person, which is contributed this week by Joanna Lewis, and it's headed Sleep Deprived at Christmas. Jerry, would you take this one, please?
Sleep that knits up the ravelled sleeve of care. If you've got seasonally affected insomnia like me, then Shakespeare's wonderful line from Macbeth will speak to you. How many of you out there are falling into bed totally pooped and then find you're suddenly wide awake at 2 a.m, still at 3 a.m, and even 5 a.m? You finally drop off. But half an hour later, the alarm goes off. However, you're in the middle of such a horrible dream about losing all your data on your laptop or having to resit your maths GCSE in the middle of a Take That concert, that you're actually relieved to be awake. It's horrible. If you're lucky and, like Margaret Thatcher, able to run a country on 6 hours a night, then you can shrug it off. I so admire people who do shift work and cope with disrupted sleep. But me, if I have less than 6 hours over a week, at the end of it, I look like I've just come back from my own funeral. The problem worsens when insomnia impacts on your daily life. I will always maintain that the reason I recently drove into a metal pillar in the Chesil multi-story and later reversed into a delivery van was down to the effects of insomnia. Although, Millard, I'd like two earlier offences against a wheelie bin to be taken into account. At least I know I'm not alone. One of my friends has joined a wide awake club. People with insomnia can talk to each other through social media in the wee small hours. My mother's been suffering too. She's become such an expert on international affairs after listening to the World Service at night. I was surprised not to see her on Channel 4 News commenting on Robert Mugabe and the coup in Zimbabwe. In the run-up to Christmas, it's not surprising we're sleep-deprived, wired from extra work, worried about money, wondering have we re-gifted that foot spa to the same aunt it came from last year? Or how can I stop Grandad feeding the dachshund turkey this year so his IBS doesn't decorate the cream sofa again? What can we do? Well, there's sleep-inducing rituals, also called, less appealingly, sleep hygiene. This means switching off the TV and phone 2 hours before you go to sleep. The same routine. No tea or coffee after 11 a.m. Blackout curtains. Remove room clutter. Use earplugs, eye mask, silk pillow and knitted bed socks. In terms of the number of rules and procedures, it's like preparing for special ops behind enemy lines in the mountains of Afghanistan. I just want a good night's sleep, not to combat the Taliban. Although maybe I could do my bit. I've been awake so much I've developed nighttime vision. There's also the right music. Currently I've got Rainforest, Lapping Shoreline and Whales Communicating Underwater. It's like a David Attenborough after party. Insomnia is a serious problem affecting 30% of British adults. At its worst, it triggers depression, with a knock-on effect on general health. It's also linked to the epidemic in painkiller addiction, as people look for quick fixes to get enough sleep to sustain busy lives. So, we need to find more gentle, long-term and sustainable solutions. Thinking about this, I happened to hear Roderick Williams' choral setting of a 16th century poem by St. Teresa of Avila. "Let nothing trouble you," she wrote. "Everything is fleeting." Good advice if you've woken up realising you photocopied your bottom at the Xmas party. But it's also a nod to mindfulness and meditation, regularly taking time out to stand back from all the trivia and find your own inner calm. I've signed up for a course in the new year. It could cure my insomnia and even help me with my parking. After all, it is the season of miracles.
Well, we have a couple of items from Belgarum this week, and Jerry has the first. Thank you.
Which is entitled "Veterans Celebrates 100th Birthday." Second World War pilot and resident of Sunrise of Winchester, Tony Farrell, has been presented with France's highest military honour on the day of his 100th birthday. Surrounded by friends, family, dignitaries and his former flying students, Tony was presented with the insignia of the Chevalier de Légion d'Honneur, Knight of the Legion of Honour, by French consul Captain François Jean, on behalf of the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, for his achievements as a mosquito pilot during the liberation of France in 1944. Tony was also greeted with a telegram from the Queen, delivered by the Mayor of Winchester. An emotive speech was given by the Deputy Lord Lieutenant of Hampshire, Brigadier David Harrison, who spoke about Tony's wartime role. On top of his 50-year flying career, Tony was a big family man, and his son Clive gave a heartfelt speech thanking his father for the upbringing he received. Also in attendance were Tony's other children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren. The party included a buffet lunch, birthday cake and a rendition of Happy Birthday. The party was the culmination of a week of celebrations for Tony, during which he was guest of honour at a top-table lunch in the officers' mess at RAF Boscombe Down, was given a Chinook flypast at Worthy Down, and was guest of honour at his former flying students' Hamble reunion.
Well earned indeed, I think.
This next article is headlined "Gerard's Cancer Battle." He has been dubbed one of the greatest wine professionals of his generation. Hampshire hotelier Gerard Bassett is a former world champion sommelier and the only person to hold three major titles simultaneously: Master of Wine, Master Sommelier, and an MBA in wine. Gerard, 60, co-founded Hotel du Vin in Winchester in 1994, and now, with his wife Nina, runs the award-winning Hotel Terravina in the New Forest. But he is currently absent from the business after being diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus. Gerard is currently receiving treatment at Southampton General Hospital and the Spire Hospital in the city, and faces a major operation early next year. Gerard has vowed to beat the disease, telling friends and well-wishers, "This is just another challenge. I will fight head-on and win." His illness became public after Nina wrote a blog to explain his absence from the establishment they have run since 2007. In a series of upbeat forecasts for 2018, she wrote, "Gerard will win his battle, and we will come through this period of challenge. Gerard may be conspicuous by his absence in the short term, but he remains very much a vital part of Terravina, and we will miss him being with us whilst he concentrates on his treatment."
Thank you very much. Now we move on to historical items, and I shall start with the first, which is 200 years ago. 200 years ago, on Monday, December the 8th, 1817, an unfortunate occurrence took place in our river last Saturday evening. A boat belonging to the Custom House, which was stationed at Calshot Castle, was upset in a squall of wind off Fawley, and all on board, except one boatman named Smith, met a watery grave. Their names were Mr. Thomas Gowland, chief officer, Daniel Turber, second officer, George Pierce, William Frame, Thomas Powell, James Rudran, boatsman, and Wyn Fost, one of the gunners at the castle. They were all married men, with families. None of their bodies or the boat have yet been found. Several humane gentlemen have opened a subscription to relieve their widows and children. And second item, 200 years ago. Yesterday morning, about 2 o'clock, some villains entered the dwelling house of Mr. Richard Fritt at Cheriton near Alsford by means of a ladder, which they placed against the chamber window. They then said they wanted lodgings, and when Mr. F. opened the casement to speak to them, one of the robbers put a ladder between the window frame and the casement and got into the chamber. He then told him if he did not give him £20 immediately, he would blow his brains out. Mr. F. gave him a number of notes, which has since been ascertained to be £25. The fellow then said, "I know you have a quantity of gold in the house, which you must give me immediately, or I'll blow your brains out." He then gave him this when one of the accomplices, who was below, desired his partner to be expeditious, as there were some people moving, and at the same time the maidservant ran into the parish to alarm some of the neighbours. But before they could render any assistance, the villains, four in number, made their escape.
100 years ago, Saturday, December the 8th, 1917. At a meeting of the Main Roads and Improvement Committee on November the 13th, a letter from the Winchester Brewery Co. Limited was read, in which they offered to give up the necessary strip of land for widening the northwest corner of North Walls and suggested that the council might consider undertaking to carry out the work at once. Alderman Fords presented the minutes. Referring to the improvement at the corner of North Walls and Hyde Street, he said that the negotiations had been carried a step further and this very valued improvement would take place with the hearty cooperation and goodwill of the owners, with the result that the town would be enabled, at the moderate cost of £100 or £120, to obtain a notable improvement, both in the matter of the roadway and pavement. And the second item says, at Oddfellows Hall, Winchester, on Wednesday evening, a meeting of delegates from the various various Winchester branches of trades unions was held to discuss a proposal to form a trade and labour council for Winchester. Mr. R. Howard, National Union of Railway Men of Basingstoke, attended and gave a stirring address upon the success which had attended the formation of a Trades and Labour Council in Basingstoke. He explained how such a council could keep watch over the interests of working men in such matters as housing, in the provision of allotments, in the booking of schemes to improve private property with public money. Also, how they could arrange for lectures by leading men in politics and labour to widen the view of the workers.
And a little bit more recently, 50 years ago, Saturday, December the 2nd, 1967. The first article was about, at present there are 1,280 applicants on the council's housing waiting list, it was announced. The council was told that in 21 years, the waiting list had grown by almost 400. The details were contained in a special report on housing progress in the area. Of the 189 dwellings programmed for 1966 to 67, 13 houses, 15 bungalows, and 30 flats have been completed. Contracts have been let for the remaining 131 dwellings. All the completed dwellings, except 6 bungalows at Itchen Abbas and 5 at Compton, have been built in the Kingsworthy and Springvale area. And the second article, which some of us may well remember, is titled, With Foot and Mouth Outbreaks Still Occurring in Northern and Western Counties, Farmers in Hampshire are increasing their precautions to prevent the spread of the disease to this county. More public open spaces are being closed every day. Farmers are keeping their entrances well guarded, and a good deal of controversy over the New Forest has arisen. Last week, Winchester College closed St. Catherine's Hill to the public, and similar signs to those that went up on the hill now appear in many other spots that could harbour the disease. This week, more than any other, the threat to the New Forest has come home to everybody. Arrangements at the end of the week were being made for the whole of the forest to be sealed off with disinfectant mats at all road entrances, but a shortage of labour has delayed the matter.
25 years ago, Friday, December the 4th, 1992. A leading Hampshire Parish Council spokesman has commented on the changes that will affect small councils in the wake of local government reorganisation. In the foreword to the Hampshire Association of Parish Councils annual report, Chairman Geoffrey Owen told councillors, "Be strong and of good courage. There are testing times ahead. If we don't get it right this time, we never will." This association and every individual parish and town council in Hampshire will need to address the future of the parish movement. Some may wish to assume more powers and responsibilities, in which case the financing of the work will have to be considered. And the second item. The new Winchester Crown Court Witness Service, which offers support to crime victims, was officially launched by Mr. Justice Hutchison on Wednesday. The service is run by Coordinator Carolyn Martin and 24 trained volunteers who offer witnesses advice, friendly and confidential support, and practical help when they attend the Crown Court. Previously, witnesses had no such sanctuary, and there was always a danger that they would come face to face with the defendant.
Thank you both very much indeed for all of that. There's a concert for the gift of sight. Well-known author Bill Bryson will be coming to Romsey Abbey on Friday, December the 15th, to perform a reading at the Gift of Sight annual Christmas Carol Concert. Former South Today presenter Bruce Parker will introduce the concert by Aurum Vocal, one of London's top choirs, conducted by Nicholas Wilkes and directed by David Clegg. The composer, Alexander Lestrange, will also be conducting two of his atmospheric pieces among the wide selection of other seasonal and choral music. The Gift of Sight Eye Research Centre is based at Southampton General Hospital and specialises in age-related macular degeneration, nystagmus, inherited retinal diseases, glaucoma and conditions. Researchers combine laboratory research with treating patients in weekly clinics. The tickets are available from the Romsey Tourist Information Centre on 01794 512 987. That's 01794 512 987. It sounds wonderful, the concert for the gift of sight at Romsey Abbey on Friday, December the 15th. And more concerts to tell you about. On Friday, December the 15th, the Cathedral Carol Concert, that's Winchester Cathedral, is at 7 p.m. An evening of musical entertainment with the Cathedral Choirs, introduced by BBC South Today's Sally Taylor. And the box office for that is 01-97962-857-275. That's 01-962-857-275. And that's all the concerts that we have for you this week. And I hope you do manage to get to a few of the items. They're usually very entertaining and well worth seeing. And so we move on now to items of general news. And Jerry has the first item to read for us today, please.
Almshouse hailed among the best. The Hospital of St Cross has been hailed as one of the top 10 homes and gardens in the country. The almshouse has been chosen as part of Historic England's campaign to highlight the glories of England and best tell our national story. TV presenter George Clark judged the Homes and Gardens category from hundreds of public nominations in Historic England's campaign, A History of England in 100 Places. The hospital, established in 1132, is the oldest almshouse still in existence and one of England's oldest charitable institutions. They've been described by the writer Simon Jenkins as England's most perfect almshouses. After the dissolution of the monasteries, only a few almshouses remained, making this survival even more important. Duncan Wilson, chief executive of Historic England, said, "The history of our homes and gardens is the story of how we and our ancestors lived, and George Clark has chosen 10 fascinating places in this category, from the earliest form of social housing to the home of our monarch, and even to brutalistic streets in the sky, which took people away from the degradation of the slums. These 10 places play an important role in telling the social history of England." Mark Hughes, Group Chief Executive of Ecclesiastical Insurance, which has sponsored the initiative, said, "Places such as the Almshouse of St Cross, Winchester, are not necessarily places that come to mind when you think of England's homes and gardens, but they are an irreplaceable part of our modern heritage, and it's right that they're represented in this list alongside Windsor Castle and Blenheim Palace." The other 9 homes and gardens chosen by Mr Clark were Windsor Castle, the oldest inhabited castle in the world, Birkenhead Park, Mersey, from 1847, the first publicly funded park in the world, Park Hill Flats, Sheffield's Built in the Sky, late 1950, Park Hill's Streets in the Sky, a groundbreaking council estate, post-war prefabricated bungalows, Moseley, Birmingham, still lived in 70 years on as a testament to and symbol of post-war recovery, innovation and optimism for a brighter future. Blenheim Palace, Oxfordshire, ancestral home of the Duke of Marlborough. Port Sunlight, Wirral, planned model village for factory workers. Great Somerford, free gardens and allotments, Wiltshire, the oldest continuously cultivated allotments in England. RHS Garden Wisley, Woking, Surrey, and Osborne House, East Cowes, Isle of Wight.
And here's a good news story, and it's titled "Pupils on Red Carpet for Role in Fly Fishing Documentary." 2 Winchester school children and their fly fishing headmistress swapped their waders for the West End's red carpet after being cast in a TV documentary celebrating the importance of our chalk streams. The young members of Princess Mead's school fishing club, Edward Gibbs and Imogen Nichols, both aged 12, and headmistress Penelope Kirk, joined fishing TV presenter Ray Barras and other big names from the fly fishing world for the London premiere of Chalk, Bedrock of Fly Fishing. The Kingsworthy School head, Miss Kirk, said, "I got hooked as a child when I was taught to fly fish by my father. I wanted to pass on that passion for river sports to the next generation of fishermen and teach them about the wonders of nature that we have right here in our Hampshire rivers. The Itchen and Test are two of the most iconic rivers in Great Britain." A champion of the educational benefits of learning to fish, Miss Kirk coordinates the unusual after-school fishing club for years 4, 5, and 6 children at Simon Cooper's fishing breaks at Nether Wallop Mill. Miss Kirk added, "Fly fishing takes time to learn and teaches children to focus, to have patience, be resilient, and also helps them with their coordination. But most of all, it gives them a beautiful environment right here on our doorstep in Hampshire, where they can be still and de-stress away from all the digital distractions of daily modern life."
Here's a heading to intrigue. Grill police on Christmas safety. Hampshire residents will have a chance to quiz police chiefs on their efforts to keep the county safe this Christmas. Chief Constable Olivia Pinckney will be under the spotlight when the Commissioner's Performance, Accountability, Scrutiny and Strategy Group meet next month. Police and Crime Commissioner Michael Lane will quiz the Chief Constable on her plan of action over a festive period, when accidents and incidents of online fraud, home burglaries and drink driving tend to increase. The meeting, on Tuesday, December the 12th, will be filmed and available via access via hampshire-pcc.gov.uk. That's via hampshire-pcc.gov.uk. And ahead of this meeting, residents are invited to submit questions to Mr. Lane to put to the Chief Constable on their behalf.
Just now I read an article about the beauties and value of St. Cross to our English heritage. So I think this is interesting. It's entitled "Trustee Resigns." A city councillor has resigned from the board of the Hospital of St. Cross after calling for it to be converted into an upmarket hotel. The hospital is believed to be the oldest charitable institution in the country, dating back to the Middle Ages. Councillor Ian Tate said the building was no longer fit for purpose as sheltered housing and suggested it should be sold and new accommodation built for the brothers, the residents. A story in the Chronicle led to numerous protests and calls for him to step down. The Chronicle understands that Council Leader Caroline Horrell will announce his resignation at the Cabinet after the Chronicle went to press yesterday. He will be replaced by Councillor Fiona Mather as Council representative. Councillor Tate would only say, "I'm standing down as a trustee and I believe Councillor Mather will be the nominated appointment."
Well, moving on from that, here's something a little bit lighter, and it's titled "A Record Number of Santas Take Part in the 5K City Run." Winchester's largest ever Santa Fun Run saw hundreds of dressed-up residents take to the streets. Naomi House and Jack's Place held their annual festive event to help raise funds for children and young adults cared for at their hospices. The 5K route began at the Guildhall and took the 850 Santas all over the city. The run saw 700 Santas take place last year, but this year it sold out early in November, leading organisers to add a further 150 places. The charity has raised £17,500 so far towards the cost of providing a magical Christmas to the region's life-limited and life-threatened children. Each participant was given a Santa suit to wear and keep, and a medal to mark their achievement. Naomi House and Jack's Place chief executive, Mark Smith, said, "It was brilliantly supported, as always. Many regard it as the start of Christmas. It's a great family event. This is our 9th year, and we are growing and growing. For the charity's 21st anniversary and the 10th Winchester Centre run, we are hoping to reach 1,000 runners. So keep an eye out for registration."
And this next item is about the police. It's headed Police Team Honoured for Hurricane Bravery. A team of Hampshire police officers deployed to help in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma have been honoured at a special ceremony. Inspector Alex Redding, PC Stuart Woods, PC Terry Cook, PC David Tester and PC Martin Daniels flew to the British Virgin Islands to devastating scenes. With no running water or mains electricity, no roof on their accommodation and dangerous criminals on the loose, the team were honoured for showing great determination and bravery to help those in need. Their deployment, which lasted just 3 weeks, they helped to secure the prisoners, to assist the military with establishing water and electricity supplies, and clear dangerous debris. Most days saw the team working 16-hour shifts, with downtime spent in the community helping residents to rebuild their houses. And to top it off, it was done in searing 40 degrees heat while wearing uniforms designed for British weather and not the Caribbean. Food was also in short supply, and the team relied on basic rations to get them through. They even refused to leave when a second category 500... I'm going to say that again. They even refused to leave when a second category 5 hurricane hit the island, insisting that they wanted to be there for those who needed them most. Presenting the awards, Hampshire's Chief Constable Olivia Pinkney said, "It was a tremendous honour to present these awards to officers from Hampshire and the West Thames Valley. These officers are a true credit to the policing family and the community they serve. They have dealt with some of the most challenging situations that any officer can face, and they have shown nothing but great professionalism and compassion. I am so proud of them all, and residents living in Hampshire should take great comfort in knowing that such dedicated officers are working hard every day to make our community safer." They were joined by officers from Thames Valley Police. Hurricane Irma was the strongest observed in the Atlantic since Wilma in 2005, with winds of up to 185 miles per hour. It caused more than 130 deaths and damage estimated at around $66 billion, the fifth costliest on record. Irma was the first Category 5 hurricane on record to strike that part of the Caribbean.
Kidnap victim forced to buy a £5,000 ring. A man was kidnapped at knife point in a car before being forced to buy a £5,000 ring in Winchester for a drug dealer during a 5-hour ordeal, a court heard. Corrie Jane Falconer-Smith stands accused of the kidnap and robbery of the victim, along with co-defendants Rhys Harding and David Emmanuel Hill, who have recently entered guilty pleas. During the trial of Falconer-Smith at Winchester Crown Court, a jury heard how the man had fallen prey to the defendants following a night out in Andover. The 36-year-old accepts her role as the driver during the incident, but has entered a not guilty plea with a defence of duress, claiming she drove to a bus stop with the sole intention of scoring drugs and that her son's safety was threatened if she did not comply with her co-defendant's demands. Prosecuting Andrew Houston said the victim came to the attention of Harding, a London drug dealer, and Hill after he was seen driving his BMW. In their mindset, as the victim was driving a nice car and wearing smart shoes, they thought he must be a drug dealer. The court then heard the victim was approached by Hill, who was carrying a knife, and Harding, carrying a cutthroat razor, asking for packets, cocaine. Mr. Houston added, "The victim was threatened with a knife and bundled into a car and robbed. He was taken on a journey from Andover to Winchester to buy the £5,000 ring from Offord and Sons Jewellers. The sale was declined. The trial continues."
And this is a story for all of those football fans out there. And it's headed, "Start the car, City climb up to third spot." And this is about the Winchester City v Evesham United match, which Winchester won 2-0. Winchester City are up to third in the EvoStick Southwest after a truly satisfying win over promotion rivals Evesham United. Buoyed by a positive midweek result at North Lee, manager Craig Davis made just one change to his starting lineup, with Adam Tomaso returning after a four-match suspension in place of the unavailable Liam Gilbert. It left City with a wealth of talent on the bench, and it was two substitutes, Robert Carr and I.K. Hill, who grabbed the all-important second-half goals. Winger Carr broke the deadlock on 63 minutes with a free kick that eluded everyone on its way in. Carr was instrumental in the second goal. Evesham's former Salisbury goalkeeper, Kevin Sawyer, was unable to hold his shot, allowing Hill to bury the loose ball in the 80th minute. It was 17-year-old I.K. Hill's first Southern League goal, having previously scored against Fleet in the Hampshire Senior Cup last season. He said, "It was a bit of a battle, really. Teams don't want to give an inch in this league, but we stood up to it," said Davis. "We went back to basics in training, just practicing clearances, and it's paid dividends. Anyone would like a squad of the calibre of Evesham's, but we nullified them completely. And the fact we introduced Rob and IK after 55 and 60 minutes goes to show just how good our squad is. I'm really proud of the lads." Early on, Ryan Price made an important block to deny Paul Fahey, and the dangerous Lewis Powell hit a free kick just off target, while at the other end, Andy Jenkinson had a routine shot saved, and generally defences were on top in a goalless first half. In the second half, Ryan Price did just enough to deflect the ball away from Paul Fahey with an outstretched hand. But Winchester then replaced Andy Jenkinson and Simba Malambo with Carr and Hill. After their goals, Evesham tried hard to get back into the game, but Winchester defended very well, denying them any clear chances to secure a well-earned win.
Right, thank you everyone for the general news, and that leads us on to lighting up time. On Saturday, the 9th of December, the sun will set at 3:58 p.m. and on Wednesday, the 8th of December, the sun will rise at 8:01 a.m. and will set at 3:58 p.m. Well, that's the items of new features and general news that we usually give to you in the Hampshire Chronicle. Before we go, another reminder here that Irene Dowding is the person to call if you have any problems with your recording. And her number again is 01962 870 370. That's Irene Dowding to help you with your recording. So, we want to thank our support teams for the preparation and dispatch of this edition, to our editors Gordon and Liz, and of course many thanks to our readers, Andrew.
Goodbye now.
And Jerry.
Bye.
And from me, Roz, goodbye until the next time. Would you please put the memory stick into the wallet when you've finished with it and return it to us as soon as possible? And thank you very much for listening. Until the next time, goodbye.